Hello, baby.
The Cocktail Nation.
Anatomy of a Lounge Lothario.
Hey, baby.
I got a lot of money.
Howard, please. This is beneath
you. No, this is exactly me.
Casanova. You are evil, Demeter.
What you call me? It's not true.
Is it joke, my dove?
Why do you men so treasure this joking so?
Do you love me?
What can I say when you ask? You shouldn't ask, you know. I'll tell you when I feel like it.
Would you like me to give you something to make you sleep?
Now, there's a good idea.
All right, then. Come with me.
Welcome to another look at the Bon Vivants, Playboys, and those who lived a jet setter lifestyle. And this week I'm bringing you one very interesting man by the name of Prince Ali Khan. And this guy, I tell you what, he absolutely epitomizes the mid-century playboy. He's a man born into wealth, extremely good-looking, exotic with his mix of Italian and Oriental heritage. And he seems solemnly determined to prove that he could do everything anyone else could do, only faster. And he's always at the top of the hunt when he rode to the hounds. He raced his horses with reckless abandon. He drove in famous Grand Prix races in France, Monaco, and Italy. And to Prince Ali Khan, it was all fabulously fun, which is how he described a 10,000-mile round-trip flight, the longest civil flight ever out of India, from Bombay to Singapore in 1932. Flying over treacherous jungles in a single-engine plane with no radio. He had a lot of experience at big-game hunting. He bagged 3 lions, 7 tigers, and some 20 leopards and panthers while on foot, not from the safety of an elevated platform. And just like his father, the Aga Khan, who is head of thousands and thousands of Muslims, he was never attracted to Oriental women. When he was 23, he was deeply in love. She was a tall, slim, English beauty, 3 years his senior, fair and slightly haughty, and she was married. Her name was Mrs. Lowell Guinness. It was at a dinner party in Deauville in the late summer of 1933 that Ali met Joan while her husband was abroad. There is a story that Ali was so taken by her at first sight that he leaned across the table and said, "Darling, will you marry me?" She laughed and said, "Look, I'm already married and I've got a young kid." But that didn't stop Prince Ali Khan. He wooed her with flowers, private romantic messages as well, until she finally agreed to meet him secretly. Soon they embarked upon a very serious and all-consuming affair that culminated 18 months later in a sensational divorce trial that made the front pages of newspapers worldwide. In 1936, Joan and Ali were married quietly in Paris with the Aga Khan present. The bride wore a simple black ensemble trimmed in white and broad-brimmed black straw hat with a white bow that framed her narrow face. In the photographs, your eyes drawn to the Aga Khan who's sitting there with his metal-framed glasses glittering in the bright spring sun. However, he may have felt about the public nature of his son's romance and winning of a bride. There is little doubt that he had great hopes that the marriage and fatherhood would bring Ali a sense of maturity and of his own responsibilities. Yet Ali's marriage did nothing to dampen his interest in speed, sports, bloodstock and women. And during World War II, he served with British intelligence services in the Middle East. His immediate superior officer, Colonel A.D. Wintle, remembers being told the only risk was that he was irresistible to women and could not leave them alone. And the Germans knew it. After the war, Ali was often seen without his wife in Monte Carlo and in the chic clubs and casinos on the Riviera. Ali's romantic adventures brought him international fame, press stepping lively to keep up with the most recent source of his attention. Attractive women had a startling effect on Ali. A beautiful young society matron sitting across from him at dinner recalled that he suddenly started staring at me very intently, not moving his eyes. Then his nostrils began to flare. That seems a little bit weird, I must say. One of Ali's favourite diversions when not pursuing women or one of his demanding sporting activities was viewing movies. And he added in a projector and a screen to his Chateau d'Horizon. In the early days of the summer of 48, the most popular film in Europe was Gilda, starring Rita Hayworth, a role that earned her the name of Hollywood's love goddess. And Ali had the film run several times. He was fascinated by Rita as she sang. Ali had just finished a short affair with Pamela Churchill. She was the daughter-in-law of Winston Churchill. And it was around this time that he learned that Rita was on the Riviera. He had voiced his desire to meet Rita to Elsa Maxwell, who was a gossip columnist and friend and also an enemy to the rich and famous, who was grossly overweight and celibate and renowned for her parties, which were always paid for by other people. Lady Luck was in his corner. Rita Hayworth was arriving in Europe at any moment, and it so happened that Elsa was helping to arrange a party at the elegant Palm Beach Casino. She promised Ali Khan to make sure that Rita was invited and that he would be sitting next to her. At the time, the love goddess was married to the actor-director Orson Welles, but the marriage had fallen apart and Welles was living with an Italian woman at the time. Not that Rita needed to be lonely. She was being wooed at the time by Aristotle Onassis, but chose to ignore telephone calls, flowers and gifts from this powerful man. The failure of her marriage had been an enormous disappointment. She greatly admired Welles and they had a little daughter called Rebecca. She was in a depressed state and considering returning to the States sooner than she'd planned. Maxwell urged her to attend the party where Ali Khan was going to be the guest. Rita said, "Look, I've got nothing to wear." Not a woman to give up easily. Maxwell told her to go out and buy a dress at the boutique of the Hotel du Cap where Rita was staying. She said, "Come in late, make an entrance." It was nearly midnight when supper was to be served. Everyone had arrived an hour or so earlier. The room was glittering, the doors thrown open to the soft breezes of the Mediterranean night. And Rita stood on a landing, before her dressed in a stark white Grecian gown that hugged her sun-bronzed, shapely body. Her red hair was loose about her bare shoulders, and around her neck was a shimmering emerald diamond necklace. She looked spectacular, and heads turned toward her as she started to descend slowly and majestically. Ali was at her side when she reached the bottom step, and never more than an arm's length from her for the rest of the evening. He was a smooth and expert dancer. He was equally adept at seduction. At about 3, they left the party, drove up to the precipitous Grand Corniche that overlooks the Mediterranean coastline miles below, a ribbon of lights charting its path. She was certainly charmed by the Prince Ali Khan because she went back to the Chateau de Horizon with him and did not return to her hotel until later that morning. Ali was to have flown the next day in his private plane, the Avenger, to Ireland, but he decided to cancel his trip. Rita had agreed to return to his white seaside villa in the afternoon. And when she arrived 3 hours late for her appointment, she was dressed in white shorts, her hair loose and her face free of makeup. Ali was stunned by her natural beauty. They danced cheek to cheek in the grand ballroom of the spectacular house, just the two of them, a record spinning Gershwin, Porter, and Berlin. When he left for Ireland the next morning, Rita promised that she would remain in the south of France until his scheduled return 5 days later. Rita was deluged daily with huge bouquets of red roses. The day before his return, a gypsy woman who spoke Italian was accompanied by a translator, appeared at Rita's hotel and she insisted on seeing her. Intrigued, Rita asked her up to the suite, and the woman predicted that she was about to embark upon the greatest romance of her life, and that he was someone she already knew. The gypsy insisted that she must relent and give in to him totally. Only if she did that would she find happiness at long last. It sounds like Ali might have had a bit of a hand in this scenario. Rita was strangely convinced by the fortune teller's words, and she extended her trip by 10 days, before she was committed to start a new film and would have to return to the US. Eventually, Ali proposed marriage to her, promising that he would apply for an immediate divorce. To his shock, she refused him, and shortly after, she left for Hollywood to be reunited with her young daughter, Rebecca Wells. Ali followed in hot pursuit. He took a Mediterranean-style house across the street from her movie star mansion in Brentwood and plied her with gifts of jewelry and a small poodle puppy. Before long, they were spending almost every evening together, usually at Ali's, so that Rebecca would not be aware of the depth of the affair and to avoid the press. Now, one thing that I need to mention is that the Aga Khan was a major influence in Ali Khan's life. Now, of course, that's his dad, but the problem was Prince Ali Khan is royalty, and the Aga Khan was getting old and eventually would have to pass on his mantle to his son. Or did he? Now, the Aga Khan began to put pressure on Ali to end the affair with Rita, or stop seeing her until the divorce from Joan, who he very much liked actually, was arranged. It was not that he did not understand how Ali could be enamored by such a beautiful woman. He was the last one to cast stones. But he'd always dealt with the women in his life in a discreet fashion. It did no good for Ali to explain to him that Rita was a famous movie star whose every move was alerted to the press. Finally, plans were set in motion for Rita and Ali to meet the Aga Khan. But what the Aga Khan did not know at the time was that his son's mistress was pregnant. The Aga Khan finally gave his approval for the marriage, but it was not until he was assured that Joan would be well provided for that this would be acceptable. Joan did what had to be done with great dignity and speed and secured a divorce in Paris. There was also the matter of the prenup agreement for Rita, perhaps to prove the depth of her emotions for Ali or to savour her integrity in the matter. She rejected any arrangement to receive money from Ali should the marriage fail. In appreciation, he presented her with a magnificent diamond necklace valued at $150,000, and the wedding was set for May 27, 1949. As the day grew closer, Rita began to panic. She was aware of the Aga Khan's reluctant approval, and she'd been warned by many friends that Ali would never be faithful. Orson Welles, who she was always to stay close to, was her greatest love, was in Rome at the time, and she telephoned him before the wedding, telling him that she had to see him, that it was a terrible emergency. "I couldn't get a plane," she told a biographer. "So I went, stood up in the cargo plane. When I arrived at the hotel, there were candles and champagne ready. And Rita was in a marvellous negligee. The door closed and she said, 'Here I am, marry me.'" Orson Welles said he wasn't going to remarry her because he was otherwise involved. Nor would she find it a happy solution if he could. Against his better judgment, he had to advise her to go through with it. Orson Welles had his own reservations. He said she was marrying the most promiscuous man in Europe, just the worst marriage that could have ever happened. And she knew it. It was a fatal marriage, the worst thing that could have happened to her. He was charming, attractive, a nice man, but the wrong husband for her. The ceremony at the town hall was a media event with the reporters and the photographers all crushing together to speak to the newlyweds and to get a photograph. And the reception at his home was one of the biggest and gaudiest ever held on the Riviera. There were 500 guests, 600 bottles of champagne, 50 pounds of caviar. Rita cut the cake with a glass sword that she and Ali had found in an antique shop in Paris. She cut the cake, the band struck a chord, and the servants marched to the swimming pool, which had been scented with 200 gallons of perfume. They threw in two massive floral pieces, one shaped like an M for Margarita, and the other like an A.
Valerie near Cannes was recently the centre of attraction for all filmgoers, for it was here that Rita Hayworth's wedding took place. The Aga Khan was there, of course, but the chief interest centred on Prince Ali and his bride, who were welcomed by the communist mayor of Valerie. Under the glare of arc lamps, the ceremony was performed by the mayor, and Margarita Cansino, just Rita to film fans, became the Princess Ali Khan. The bride, wearing an ice blue crepe dress, seemed to be facing the ordeal perfectly calmly, and the beegum Aga Khan looked very contented. Then on to Ali's Chateau de l'Horizon, where part of the welcome consisted of the happy pair's initials in flowers floating on the perfumed swimming pool. The wedding had created world interest. Privacy was impossible. But then that's always the lot of a film star, especially if she marries a prince.
December 28, 1949, Rita gave birth in Switzerland to a daughter who they named Yasmin. And the Aga Khan saw his granddaughter for the very first time in the spring of 1950. He came away with an uneasy feeling about Ali's current wife and speculated that the marriage would be inevitably headed for collapse. And it was clear to him that Rita looked upon her marriage as a haven of peace and rest. In other words, her marriage was mainly a way of relaxing and being entertained, and this would never do for the wife of the future imam. The Aga Khan decided to press Ali on his princely duties and expected him to take a three-month tour of Ismaili communities in Africa, insisted that his new wife accompany him. The trip was a terrible experience. They quarreled violently. Rita was left to herself as Ali met his father's followers, and she had no idea how to fill her time in places like Zanzibar and Nairobi. Ali carried off his assignments as an emissary for the Aga Khan with great enthusiasm. But the problem was that he also managed to find some time for some numerous liaisons with women, and late one night Ali came back to their hotel to find that Rita was returning to the United States for 2 months. He correctly suspected that she was planning to end the marriage. Rita began divorce proceedings After she reached the US, she began to negotiate a new studio contract. She instigated legal action to ensure that Yasmin would be given a $3 million trust fund. As Ali Khan was struggling to extricate himself from his second marriage, he fell in love again, this time with another film star, Gene Tierney, who'd made a sensation in the title role of the film Laura in 1944. They met in Argentina, where Ali had flown in for some racehorse business. Eventually, Ali was keen to marry Gene, but the Aga Khan was adamant that his son would not, marry another movie star. And then if he did, he would risk any chance of becoming Iman upon Aga Khan's death. So Ali went back to Gene and said, look, this is not going to happen. How about you just stay on as mistress? She wasn't keen on that idea. Ali's troubles were certainly creating great problems for the Aga Khan. There had been a subversive campaign among members of the sect calling for his and Ali's abdication from their spiritual leadership position. While the Aga Khan was visiting Africa in 1953, things reached such a pitch that a special counsel was called to meet in his hotel suite to discuss what should be done. The end result was a decision that all members of the East African communities would be requested to sign a declaration of loyalty to the Aga Khan or be excommunicated if they refused. Things were heating up. By 1956, Aga Khan's heart was failing. Cancer was spreading throughout his body. It was only a matter of time. In the early morning of July 11, the family began their vigil by the dying man's bedside. In his last days, he made no mention or sign of who was to succeed him. It would be by the natural course of things, following historical precedent, that his elder son, Prince Ali, would become the new Imam. And Ali was pretty confident this would be the case. Following the death of the Aga Khan, official protocol began. And the Aga Khan's personal lawyer, Dr. Otto Giesen, along with other lawyers, arrived, brought out the will, and began to read. It read as this. Ever since the time of my ancestor Ali, the first Imam, that is to say over a period of some 1300 years, it has always been the tradition of our family that each Imam chose his successor at his absolute and unfettered discretion from amongst any of his descendants, whether they be sons or a remoter male issue. Ali knew exactly what this meant. He had been passed over. In view of the fundamentally altered conditions in the world in recent years, I'm convinced that it is in the best interest that I should be succeeded by a young man who has been brought up and developed during recent years in the midst of the new age. For this reason, I appoint my grandson, Karim, the son of my son, to succeed the title. Ali had been passed over. Ali's eldest son by Joan, Karim, had proved himself to be a responsible young man, attended Harvard, and exhibited little of his father's wild streak. As much as Ali might have suspected his father could have passed him by, he was unprepared when the Aga Khan's final words were read. His then girlfriend, the fashion model Simone Bodin, recalled that his father's preference for Karim was a kind of public humiliation. He was never quite the same from that day on. Eventually, Ali was able to pull himself up by his britches and he became acquainted with Pakistan's president, who offered him a position as the country's permanent spokesperson in the United Nations. And Ali Khan accepted this, and in 1958, he was in the United Nations. Funny enough, though, as part of his duties, of course, he would host many, many parties, but he didn't particularly like Pakistan House's decor, so he decided to get it all redone. And subsequently, his diplomatic parties and dinner receptions were so spectacular that an active black market emerged for invitations to attend these parties. Overall, he was one of the most well-known figures in the world at the time, and when a journalist asked him whether he was annoyed by the hounding of the people in the United States while he's walking the streets of New York, he said, maybe I shouldn't mention it, but it doesn't happen only in New York, you know. It's the same wherever I go. Turin, Paris, Karachi, even South America. Most people seem to know me. If they don't recognize me, they always look twice. You can tell they're thinking, I've seen that fellow somewhere before. Sadly, it all ended for Prince Ali Khan on May 13th, 1960. He was driving his Lancia sports car. He had a crash in France. His girlfriend at the time, the French model Simone Bodin, suffered a deep cut on her face. He died. Very little is known about the crash, really. The driver of the other car told the police that he couldn't remember anything about the crash. Simone gave her version of the story. She said Ali was not driving fast at the time at all. And thus ended the life of Ali. Ali Khan, killed in a car crash. A little bit like a man that we're going to be talking about a little bit later on in this series, Porfirio Rubirosa, who also died in a sports car crash. It's certainly not an uncommon way in which playboys die. Ali Khan was a very, very interesting man, a man of great style, a man of great adventure, ticking all of the boxes of the playboys, and of course, a great lover as well. Was he a man who should have been the spiritual leader? No, probably not. A Lounge Lothario to boot, there's no doubt about that. Massive spending on a grand scale, probably not unlike many oil-rich young Arab men today, I suppose. But there is one interesting thing about Prince Ali Khan, actually. He's certainly quite the romantic. Some of the wild gestures that he made to women, namely Rita Hayworth and, of course, his first wife, quite extravagant. And certainly at the time, probably one of the best known playboys of his generation. Prince Ali Khan, in our Anatomy of a Lounge Lothario on the Cocktail Nation.